You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
I do not believe that we would have had that coalition, or indeed persuaded the Bush administration to go down the UN path, without our commitment to be alongside them in this fight.
The reviews are in for Tony Blair's latest attempt to justify the decisions he made prior to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, and they're not good. Why does Tony Blair now inspire such extraordinary rage among the people, and especially the party he once led? My guests Shashank Joshi and Oscar Guardiola Rivera will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including the race to become Britain's next Prime Minister, as three contenders are reduced to two, Venezuela's continuing journey into the realms below rock bottom, and Shinzo Abe wants young Japanese people to vote on Sunday. Will a talking rice grain persuade them? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Shashank Joshi, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University. Welcome both. Now, first of all, it would be idle to pretend that the Chilcot report released yesterday was anything like an advertisement for Tony Blair. It criticised his decision-making in the run-up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq strongly and quite rightly. The most charitable analysis of Blair's behaviour is that it was hubristic overreach. The reaction from Britain's press and public, and especially the party he once led to its greatest successes, was interesting, however. Like Margaret Thatcher before him, among a hefty portion of Britain's metropolitan middle classes, Blair has become a sort of folk demon. Shashank Joshi, first of all, why?
Well, look, let's put aside the obvious reason, Iraq.
I think
people often forget he won an election in 2005. It's a fairly hapless Tory party, but he did. So what are the other reasons? And I think there's a couple. One of them is obviously the incredible furious pace of money-making activity since he's left office, notably in concert with some very unsavory governments like Kazakhstan, like some of the Gulf governments, in ways that sort of undercut the idea he was really focused on democracy and freedom. So there's that slightly grubby side of it. We associate more with American politicians giving $200,000 speeches than we do with John Major sitting in his garden in Wiltshire watching county cricket. And I think there's another side of it too, which is he's become more American as he's gone on. It's not just the sort of mid-Atlantic drawl, which is detectable when you listen to him. He's changed his voice. It's also the religiosity, that conviction politics that I think we treat slightly awkwardly. Someone like David Cameron's quite glib public schoolboy style about this. Well, Blair is now more and more religious. And indeed, this morning on Today programme, he was asked about his belief in God, the relationship to Iraq. I think we as a country, as sort of tepid Anglicans, find that slightly odd and awkward.
This is, of course, something, Oscar, that Blair does have in common with Margaret Thatcher. Not necessarily the religiosity, because that was never a huge part of her thing necessarily, but still the absolute conviction, the fact that they clearly were motivated by beliefs, or at least as they saw it themselves, motivated by principle above and beyond, I guess, basic pragmatic party politics. Is that just something that does inspire a certain amount of suspicion among British people?
Well, let us not forget that Margaret Thatcher did say that the best thing she did was to produce Tony Blair and the Blair likes. Listen, what the problem here is that Tony Blair has come to embody a malaise that is deeply widespread among politicians nowadays, which is they hide behind all this highfalutin rhetoric of conviction, of ethical, ethics, and also ideas of deep beliefs and so on and so forth, in order not to take responsibility for the mistakes that they have made. They just keep banging on. They keep saying, yes, I apologize, but... And that is the real reason. people are now seeing through the lines of so much lying, so much self-deception, and are absolutely tired
of that. Except that the one kind of, I guess, free pass he was given by Chilcot is that he wasn't at any point actually knowingly deceiving anybody. It may be arguable that he was committing the political equivalent of, you know, that the journalist who has a story that's, as we say in the trade, too good to check, and therefore doesn't make the calls that might contradict it. He may not have tried all that hard to find things that contradicted what he wished to believe, but he was acting on the information available to him at the time.
Well, not really. Actually, if you read the 12 volumes, and I'm already on volume 6, and obviously reading with my hat of international lawyer on, what you see is the truth, that actually they had the information, they had the faulty intelligence, and they decided not to challenge it. So what you see there is precisely what Blair tried to confuse. Of course, it wasn't the point of the Chilcot inquiry to establish the finer points of legality. But having said that, what is absolutely clear is that there were serious blunders here, and there they had the information. So when people see that these politicians, not just him, other politicians who give us all this deep conviction and apologies and so on, but in fact never accept what they have done, it's very difficult for us to keep on believing.
Well, you know, I don't disagree with that, but I do think that we knew a lot of that from the Butler Review in 2004 and some of the other sources very early on. And this vitriol, this sense that Blair, I mean, one of the quotes from yesterday was someone, perhaps a relative of a soldier who'd been killed, saying, Blair is the worst terrorist in the world. Now, one, of course, feels the emotion and the passionate intensity there, but it's a strange thing to say, nonetheless.
But it's
evolved later on, hasn't it?
It is certainly understandable that somebody who lost their son in a war he chose to wage would have fairly strong feelings.
Absolutely.
What's interesting to me is that the extraordinary spiteful rage he inspires among otherwise reasonable friends of mine.
I think there's two other elements here. One of them is that he was a staunch sort of centrist, centre-left person, one of the most successful centre-left politicians in the world in the 1990s. The political ground has completely shifted, of course, in the 15 years since. Yep. The left that he quashed in the early 90s within the Labour Party, the militant left, is now resurgent, certainly in the UK, and in fact has reoccupied the party he once cleansed and purged. Well, and that's emboldened them.
Actually, that is a very good point, because this is exactly what I meant when I said that people are beginning to read through the lines. It did not escape many people to see that those who defended Blair yesterday were the same ones looking to oust Jeremy Corbyn. So let's not get into the discussion concerning Corbyn. But what the point there is that the shift, the political ground is shifting, and Blair seems to be stuck in the middle. But of course, if the fault is opening, standing on thin air.
Well, it's particularly vitriolic because who occupies the political ground and ideological ground he once did? Well, it's the Cameroons, right? And of course, they're now dead too. You have two sort of Michael Howard right-wing Tory party types now competing for the election, led some in May. But the fact is, Cameron took over Blair's ground. Those who were sort of middle-class, centre-ground who supported Blair, many of them gravitated to the Tories, I think, over time. And of course, the Labour centrists are marooned within their own party, as we've seen. I think that's contributed to some of that anger at Blair in the last few years. They're emboldened to attack him as well.
Well, that does move us seamlessly along, which I'm grateful for, because it saves me having to come up with a seamless link of my own, to the prospects of the UK's next Prime Minister. As of about 90 minutes ago, it's down to a choice of two. The most recent ballot of Conservative MPs ejected from the running, Michael Gove, leaving Tory members, rather, to pick between the long-serving Home Secretary Theresa May and the Minister of State for Energy, Andrea Leadsom, who could have walked most of this nation's streets altogether unnoticed a month or so ago. Oscar, I give up basically trying to predict anything or make any sense of anything at this point. In theory, in a sane world, etc., this should be an absolute walkover for Theresa May, shouldn't it, in theory, in a sane world?
Well, in theory, it will be. But as you said, it's better not to predict anything anymore. The problem here is that we're going to have 150,000 people deciding who our next prime minister will be. And actually, it turns out that the prime minister is going to be someone who did not support Brexit.
Well, Theresa May did did not. Andrea Leadsom, of course, did.
Yes, and the Booker's money is on the former, and then even if a Brexiter gets to win the ballot, the Brexiters have already vacated most of their promises. So let's say it frankly, the Conservative Party did plunge us all into a black hole, but they solved their internal quarrel.
Shashank, this is just a theory I have been developing in the last 90 minutes or so. It may not hold up. Who knows? Little of anything else I have predicted or forecast has. Is it possible to look at this as the Conservative Party's own sort of watered-down version of Clinton versus Trump? That this is there's this experienced establishment candidate versus the frankly laughably unqualified populist upstart?
Well, who's Trump here?
Leadsom, obviously. Obviously Leadsom.
Oops. No, so there's absolutely an element of that, and that May is more experienced. She is closer to the centre ground. She campaigned for Remain and therefore was in sort of more in tune with the left of the party. And Leadsom, of course, has all kinds of, you know, flaws. She's a CV fantasist, as we now know. She ran a blog for many years in which she made a variety of homophobic, misogynistic comments that effectively, you know, one would expect from a Daily Mail comment page, but not perhaps from the Prime Minister of a country. But at the same time...
Daily Mail comments section, more like,
well,
possibly.
Well, sitting above the Clinton-Trump comparison, which is there, is, I think, the fact that actually they are both closer to each other than they are to the extremes. They are effectively both from the right of the Tory party, and this final two represents a repudiation of both a cultural style of politics that Cameron and Osborne and Boris all represented, and a reformist, you know, modernising zeal, for better or worse, that Michael Gove represented. This is a small chunk of the party, and really the Tory right that was lost out in 2001, lost out in 2005, and was expunged for a decade, is now going to strike back.
Oh, precisely. I mean, you just said that Theresa May is more in tune to the left of the party.
Towards the left.
I know what you mean. But to hear anyone to say that Theresa May is to the left of anything is quite impressive.
These things are, of course, always relative.
Less to the right.
Very relative. Yes. You know, black hole kind of relativity theory in this case.
But Oscar, how peculiar / weird / utterly terrifying is it to you that we may now be a matter of months here in the United Kingdom from an election in which we'll be invited to pick a prime minister from Jeremy Corbyn and Andrea Leadsom?
Well, it remains to be seen whether Corbyn survives.
But that is far from impossible, whereas if you had gone into a bookmaker's office a year ago with that pitch, or maybe a bit over a year ago, you could have written your own ticket.
I know. I would have bought this radio station and so on and so
and
forth.
And several others besides.
And make you director. But seriously... You were right before. The ground has shifted completely, absolutely. We are seeing the return of a kind of politics that everybody thought was gone for good. And that in itself is interesting. But of course, may you live in interesting times as a Chinese curse.
But you say a return of that kind of politics. I mean, Shashank, in terms of the British experience, is this a return or is this something completely new? British politics has always prided itself, for all its knockabout, on a certain understanding that the centre ground does revolve around a, you know, pragmatic, getting things done, not too ideological or doctrinaire.
I'm not sure. I think you're not going far back enough. I think you're looking at this from 1994 onwards. Go back a little bit, and I think Thatcher represented a iconoclastic zeal.
But I was about to advance her, I promise you, the previous exception to the rule.
Well, I mean, of course, we had a consensus for a long time, but of course, even within that, we had some sort of fairly, you know, people like Harold Wilson or people like this, there was still more ideological polarisation between a Roy Jenkins, who decriminalised homosexuality, and a sort of conservative moralistic right in the party. There was genuine, you know, more ideological debate, which was sapped progressively in the late 90s, where effectively a kind of modernising third way economic consensus began to dominate. I mean, my opinion, for the better, and thank God for it. But actually, that is now over, and we are going to see, I think, culture wars open up again, because don't forget, Corbyn does represent a staunchly pro-immigration aspect of the party. Indeed. In fact, some of his supporters are worried about that changing. That's one of the few areas where I think I share his views. We are now going to see some culture wars open up again, I think, after a decade with a prime minister who strongly supported gay marriage and was anomalous in his party for doing so, but did that. We'll see a reversion on issues. Leadsom, by the way, favours submitting all websites for classification in the way that movies are classified. I mean, this is technically a bonkers idea.
Kind of have to wish her luck with that.
Well, the fact that, I mean, of course it's ridiculous, but it's more the fact she proposes it gives you a sense of where she's ideologically coming from, which is more controlling, more conservative, more paternalistic.
While Theresa May wants GCHQ to keep listening on to everything we say and do. So, yes, we have new elements here. These, two elements. Secrecy. This idea that now the state can surveil and we need more control over our social lives while the state does not have to come clean as to why it is doing so is a new element and it's a very dangerous one. And in addition to that, as I said before, this culture of apologizing and using pseudo-ethical language to disguise one's own mistakes.
I would have to just add a small note to that, which is a coda to that. I think, by the way, I would apply that also to Corbyn and Corbynites in terms of the use of moral ethical language in ways that are often quite disingenuous. And I think the use of that, particularly on things like Iraq, where people he was associated with very closely, the Stop the War Coalition and the others they campaigned with, were urging on the Iraqi resistance in 2003 against British troops. And I am certainly disgusted.
But you cannot accuse him of that, but that's another matter.
Well, that's another debate.
It is indeed. We are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Shashank Joshi and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Coming up next, Venezuela, from bad to worse, to worse, to worse.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
Torontonians like to think of this place as one of the most diverse and one of the most tolerant anywhere in Canada, if not anywhere in the world. And the energy that brings off, I think, is really fertile ground for a journalist, a bureau chief, for Monocle as a whole to tap into and to play a key part in.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Shashank Joshi and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Now, the one thing that Venezuela does not presently have a shortage of is picturesque demonstrations of its descent into penury. Yesterday, several hundred Venezuelan women stormed a bridge on the country's theoretically closed frontier with Colombia before descending upon the first town across the border to load up on goods including cooking oil, flour and toilet paper, among the many staples currently difficult to find back home. Oscar, this passed the mere realms of ridiculous into a whole other area some time ago, the situation in Venezuela. As far as it's possible to tell, does the government have any idea where it's going with this? Is there a path to victory if you are currently President Nicolas Maduro?
No, I don't think so. I think that if we are to speak of hope, we should look at the community organizers. In fact, I was in the border not long ago, the border you mentioned, Táchira, in between Santander and Táchira, Colombia and Venezuela. And it is the case that many of the goods that these women were stormed the border for are actually Venezuelan goods, which are smuggled into Colombia. And then the price becomes all the more cheaper. I mean, migrants, Latin American migrants here in London, can relate to this because they can find the same flour that is impossible to find in Venezuela pretty much anywhere in a corner shop here in London. So that tells you that the problem, there is a a problem there with the networks of distribution, both private and state controlled. So no, let us not look for hope up high. Let us look for more hope with the grassroots. A bit like what happens in Greece. If you go there, what you find is that society, you know, being let down by its leaders and politicians, begins to reconstruct its own tissue. And that's perhaps the very dim light of hope that you can see there. But even when you talk to them, they themselves will tell you that the current situation is unsustainable, that they're very worried about the fact that it now seems that the opposition, the right-wing opposition, is not really intent on gaining power, because they know that if they do so, then they will have to face a deeply troubling situation.
Imagine somebody campaigning for something and then running away from it and refusing to take responsibility when they win
it. I've never heard anything like that. I'm British.
It would be absolutely extraordinary, wouldn't it? Yeah. I mean, Shashank, what do you think is, it's a difficult question to answer, I suspect, is going on in Maduro's head? I would like to think that if I'd ended up in charge by some doubtless ghastly mischance of an entire country and realised it had reached the stage at which people were looting food trucks, that, you know, things like, you know, Coca-Cola had ceased production because they couldn't get any sugar, that airlines were suspending flights because of currency controls, I would like to think I would either probably admit that this wasn't going terribly well and quit, or come up with a fairly radical change of direction. Why won't he do that?
Well, look, I mean, all political leaders, whether in situations dire as this or less so, suffer from cognitive dissonance and struggle to reverse decisions to which they're firmly committed. It's not an easy thing for anyone to do, least of all if you're in a highly fractious political environment. I'm not an expert on Venezuela, I know very little about Venezuela, but reading this story, I'm struck by a couple of aspects as to, in general cases, what this kind of, these economic conditions do to the psychology of leaders and people. I was struck by this idea that government supporters say empty store shelves are caused by an economic war against a socialist government. And I was also struck by the impact of this causing an immigration crisis into Colombia, the deportation of thousands of Colombians, and tensions between Colombia and Venezuela. And what it suggests to me is that when you have this kind of move towards borders being shut, immigrants being deported, scarcity, shortages, the impact is not only economic or not only domestically political, it always spills over. It always finds outlets in terms of scapegoats, minorities, those more vulnerable. It results in international tensions. And I think in Europe, where we are looking at borders, Schengen being closed down in Europe more and more, of course, Brexit, sterling plummeting, we will find ourselves in more and more situations where the economic conditions lead us to look for these scapegoats and create stress on our borders and get displaced outwards onto other countries and other people.
Oscar, the economic war upon Venezuela that Shashank noted there, that Maduro claims is being waged by some doubtless sinister cabal of forces that have got nothing better to do with
Portland Communications.
Probably them. People, I'm entranced by the idea that there's this sinister, you know, furtive cabal that's got nothing better to do with its time than undermine the legacy of Hugo Chavez. In Venezuela itself, are people buying that? Is there still any sympathy for Maduro and what he represents?
Actually, communal organizations, which in fact were the ones that gave both Chavez and Maduro their side of power, are much more intelligent than that, and we should give them credit. Yes, they would say that there is a problem with networks of distribution. They would point towards parts of the private sector which are engaged in those terrible practices, but they also know that they are not the only ones to blame. They are not engaging in a scapegoating. They're also very critical of the government, and it is because of this that one can say that he will. I see it very difficult for Maduro to end his term. But having said that, what really surprised me, being there, was the fact that the opposition does not seem ready to take power, because they know that then they will have to fix the situation.
Okay, well finally
yes,
tonight.
Another parallel.
Finally tonight, we will move on to Japan, where voters go to the polls on Sunday to choose half of the country's House of Councillors, which is the Japan's upper house. Here is a clip of Shinzo Abe attempting to rally his supporters.
Japan is moving forward. We have had big improvements in jobs and wages nationwide. We must not halt the gains, progress or retreat. We must not go back to the period of stagnation in the past. We are producing results. Let's keep to this road. Stay strong. Go forward. Liberal Democrats.
I can't pick that music. It's familiar to me from somewhere. It will come to me shortly. But like polities all around the world, Japan is morbidly concerned with encouraging the participation of younger voters. And among the stars of a marketing campaign to get the youth off their Xboxes or whatever it is they're playing with these days and into the polling stations have been a couple of burnished teenage models, a lovelorn comic strip character, and Komeisuke, who is a talking grain of rice. This is the first election since they lowered the voting age in Japan, so it's potentially significant. First big question, which I'll put to you, Shashank. I mean, I was a young person once, and I'm
shocked to hear this.
Yeah, I know, but I was a total idiot. I mean, why are we encouraging young people to vote at all?
Well, I mean, for one obvious reason, they bear the consequences of these votes for a longer period than many of others do.
How's that my problem?
Well, I mean, if you were the one-man constitutional court of Japan, or indeed the world, this might look slightly different. But I mean, that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is, if you want people to become responsible citizens and voters at a later stage in their life, they have to start somewhere. My problem with this campaign is, look, if it works, it works. I'm devastated to see how low participation was amongst under 30s in the UK for our referendum. Really, I think it's terrible. However, this really seems to be infantilizing these people. I mean, since when do 16-year-olds respond to sort of, you know, teen models talking to politicians or giant grains of rice?
Which, as you pointed out earlier, does appear to have some unsavoury dietary practices.
Well, I mean, there were two flecks of rice on their cheek, so it's a cannibalistic rice grain. This may appeal to the sort of stoner segment of Japan's 16-year-old population, but whether it's more SpongeBob SquarePants than it is serious adolescent, you know, intellect, there must be better ways than this to appeal to youth.
I mean, that's what always strikes me, Oscar, that there is nothing more toe-curling than politicians who tend to be middle-aged and up trying to talk to 20-year-olds like they've got any idea how to talk to 20-year-olds.
Invariably, they look like perverts. I mean, it's just terrible, invariably. Look, indigenous peoples in Latin America have a really good practice that I didn't understand at first. They tend to choose their youngest as, political operators and functionaries. And at first, I thought that was crazy. You know, but then they told me, no, this is the way in which they learn. They begin very young, they learn, they make mistakes, when they're young, so that when they really get into the serious stuff, when they grow up, they will not make them. Mind you, the Amerindians also make their armies with the elders of the tribe. Hmm. And I've seen them confront the guerrillas in Colombia. It's something amazing, because they shame them. And I think they're onto something. It is interesting to see more and more young people in politics, but what we must not do is to infantilize them, to think that they do not know, to think that they do not care, precisely because they care and they see what we were talking about, all this terrible environment of politicians lying and so on and so forth, that they don't bother. But if you give them the opportunity and they do engage in the political process, as I saw happening in Scotland not long ago, then you have a very different and much more interesting result.
I mean, this is an excuse to float a prejudice of mine and an idea which my own home country has embraced. But Shashank, couldn't we spare everybody this humiliation, embarrassment and nonsense by just with a mandatory vote?
Well, yes, but what you don't necessarily want is for people... The idea of this isn't just to get them in the voting booth, get bodies in the booth as fast as you can, as much as you can. The idea is surely also some degree of democratic and political engagement with the issues, with the figures involved, with the parties, with the political structures in place. So I suppose, yes, compulsory voting is one way of ensuring the turnout is high, and that is really important. But it could also generate a lot of resentment and actually lead to some sort of pretty arbitrary, erratic, fluid voting practices, which don't really turn people into citizens, just voters. And we want citizens, I suppose, if not to be too sort of high-minded about it. Although a talking grain of rice is not really going to create a citizen either, is it?
I mean, Oscar, if you can sort of imagine back to the 18-year-old self or the 18-year-old version of yourself, would a talking grain of cannibal rice have enticed you to the polling booth?
Not at all. When I was 18-year-old, I was part of the student movement in Colombia that changed the constitution.
Okay, now you're just showing off.
Absolutely.
Shashank, what about you? Cannibal, talking, perambulating rice, would that have got the 18-year-old Shashank Joshi to the polls?
I think I would have been pretty insufferable as an 18-year-old, so probably not as successful or ambitious, but certainly not atypical. I mean, I think part of it is having politicians who are able to connect, and people like Sturgeon demonstrate that.
Indeed. So Shashank Joshi and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, thank you as ever for joining us. That is all for today's edition of Midori House, which was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Patrick Hun. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. More music next at 1900. It's The Urbanist with Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck. And I'll have more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.